Hey, folks, it feels like we've been here before. We'll be here again.
Indeed.
It's episode 131 of the Paleo Solution Podcast. Greg Everett, what's going on?
Nothing. Still sitting here at my desk recording podcasts.
Dude.
But this one, we're going to straight up murder this podcast right now.
Sweet.
It's going to be the best one ever.
Curb stompage.
Yeah.
So
at least that's my goal.
Since we wrapped up the last one about 5 minutes and two peas ago, let's just jump right into this. I have nothing new to report from 5 minutes or 1 week ago. So still no baby. Still no baby. Although the time dilation of podcasting that may not be true now. So
okay. Well, since there's absolutely nothing interesting at all for us to talk about. Should we hope these questions are interesting and get to it?
Yes. Yeah.
yes, please.
You've got to read the subject line on this first one.
Yeah. Okay. So this is a tricky one here. Sleeping after long periods of being awake. Of course, my response to which was, you mean like every day? Okay.
It is intriguing. I don't know. Sorry, folks. We're getting punchy here, so.
Maybe this is after, like, some kind of meth bender, though.
Could be. Or being a doctor.
Yeah. I think meth actually keeps you sharper and more alert than doing super long shifts in the ER.
I would probably agree with that.
The theory makes sense.
All right. Chad says, hi, Rob. Really appreciate the podcast, book, website, and everything you are doing for paleo. I've only recently converted to a paleo diet, but the changes have been impressive. I'm an orthopedic surgery resident and, as such, get to enjoy the joys of being on call and having a pretty crazy schedule most of the year. I try to get as much sleep as possible, but I know that I'm often unable to get as much sleep as I feel I need. My question is this. For those days when I'm post-call, after having worked for 24 to 30 hours straight, what is the best way to go about sleeping when I get home around noon? Should I try to sleep for a good amount of time, 6 hours, then wake up for a bit before going back to bed later that night, take a shorter nap immediately when I get home, and then go to bed earlier at night, or just not sleep at all and go to bed even earlier? I'm just trying to figure out how to minimize the damage this cycle causes to my adrenals and the rest of my mind and body.
Oh, man. It's tough. To the best of your ability, try to find a pattern. Like your body will kind of fall into a more patterned response. That gets really hard. Like if you're on 3 days and then off 2 days and then on 2 days and off three, you know. So my first response would be to just try to find as much of a pattern to this stuff as you can. And then the second piece to this is get as much sleep as you can. So just all other things being equal, sleep whenever you can sleep. If you really feel like a big block of sleep in the day is going to affect your sleep at night, I guess then maybe trying to do that, like getting a jawbone and kind of, following that polyphasic sleep pattern a little bit, like the 90 minutes of, trying to come out of sleep at a 90-minute demarcation so that you're not as groggy and stuff like that. But my gut sense is that try to get a pattern and then try to get as much sleep as you can unless it really legitimately seems to mess with your nighttime sleep. But then when you're up at night, it's just tough. But that would be my gut sense of how to tackle that stuff. I've found when I travel some melatonin really helps hit the reset button. So that might be something to tinker with. And some people are really powerful responders and like a quarter milligram is the right dose for them. Other people need like 5 milligrams. So, I think there's a lot of variability there, but much more safe. And in my opinion, it would be much more effective than doing like Ambien or something like that to try to help you sleep, which really just makes you unconscious. It doesn't actually produce the state of sleep. So
how about GHB?
Ah, man, I used that stuff when it first came out, and you could buy it from a health food store, and I had amazingly good sleep. Like, it was phenomenal stuff. It's a serious bummer that it's like a Schedule 3 up there with, like, heroin now. So, yeah.
Well, too many virgins were using it to bone girls.
Yes, yes.
So, I would say that with the sleep stuff, definitely I think the primary goal needs to be getting as much sleep as you possibly can. And so when I worked on the gut bucket, you know, we would work 24-hour shifts, 7:30 to 7:30. But then I would also work dispatch shifts sometimes, and I would work graveyard from 11 to 7:30. And so, you know, on some 24s, you actually get to sleep some of the night. On a lot of them, though, you're essentially up all night, and you are working 24 hours straight. And I would come home from that, immediately take a shower, get in bed. Didn't care what my roommate was doing. Didn't care, you know, what was going on. I just needed to sleep. And, you know, if I had to work that night, obviously I really needed to get as much sleep in as possible. If I didn't have to, I'd have that whole next day off. Didn't matter. I would still come in there and sleep as much as I possibly could and then go to sleep again later that night. Because again, you know, you clearly don't have a lot of spare time to work with here. So as nice as it would be to really have a nice consistent pattern, you know, it just seems like generally it's pretty impossible to do. So I think the melatonin at night's probably a good idea too. Like if you feel like you won't be able to fall asleep, but, I definitely wouldn't try to keep yourself awake for an extra 6 hours after a 30-hour shift, just so you can sleep more solidly that night. Cause then you're still losing a bunch of sleep, but that's me.
Yeah. And, you know, just as you were talking about that, I was thinking more making sure that your vitamin D levels remain good. I would track your blood work and, you know, keep an eye on DHEA sulfate, testosterone, all that stuff, and take the steps you need to support that stuff and support the sleep too. It'll make your life a lot better.
Yes. All right. I like this subject line here. I don't want to train like a girl, but my ovaries keep getting in the way.
I have the same problem.
Where do you have your ovaries? okay. Karen says, my question is probably TMI, but here it goes. I've been paleo for the past year, and about 6 months ago, I started CrossFit. Everything has been going awesome so far with just one exception. My goals for the past couple months have been to get stronger and faster, no calorie restriction, up my protein and carbs, keeping everything heavy, and other awesome tips from my portable Greg Everett. It's awesome and everyone should buy it.
Yeah.
Thanks. My husband is on deployment, and about 3 weeks before he comes home, I'll focus on leaning out by going low carb and mixing in some intermittent fasting. Of course, IF only when I've got all my ducks in a row, sleep, eating clean on non-IF days, etc.
Good
Karen,
girl.
You are doing a great job paying attention.
Good girl.
But I have found a hiccup. The best advice I got was to not train like a girl. I lift heavy and I only whine in my head when I break a nail. But PMS is a bitch. About a week before my period, I'm a pile of shit. I can barely run 400 meters. Deadlifting my body weight feels almost impossible, and I get sore a lot easier. I know my mouth isn't a vacuum cleaner, but my stomach doesn't pay attention to my brain for that week. I destroy anything and everything that gets in my way, and it's when I usually cheat with not-so-awesome foods. I'm better at eating gluten-free junk now, but junk is still junk. I don't want to train like a girl, but my ovaries keep getting in the way. I know that I can't completely get rid of my symptoms, but it's frustrating. I feel like I make huge strides forward and then have to take a huge step back every month. The most info I can find is that it's, quote, probably normal. But I know from being paleo that normal doesn't always mean good. Is there anything else I could do to help out with my symptoms? I've been on BC before, and although it helps with PMS, but I get really bad nausea and other symptoms that last all month long. Any help? You just had that testosterone episode, and it was hilarious. Any equally insightful / funny input to offer for the fairer sex? Thanks for the podcast, and keep up the awesomeness.
You know, just commenting on that, I had somebody kind of take me to task on the testosterone stuff, and, you know, that I wasn't giving a fair shake to the XX chromosomes out there. And I explained to the woman that you can do a really good treatment of male endocrinology, testosterone, estrogen, growth hormone, insulin-like growth factor. You can do an overview that gives people a really good understanding of what's going on, and it might take you 40, 45 minutes to do it. It takes like 200 hours to properly address a female endocrinology. Is just way more complex with
you
the estrogen.
You see, ladies, why we don't ever know what the hell is going on with you.
Exactly. And so, I mean, what I told this woman was that I try to keep my nose where I feel like I've got some sort of understanding instead of pontificating on stuff that I don't know anything about, which seems to be what most of the rest of the world does, whether they're talking about, you know, like history or politics or nutritional biochemistry, as the case may be. So,
We will look into this more, but it's just a way more complex topic as just kind of a byline there. You know, the stuff that leaps out at me with this is that I know for a fact that I've seen people really improve PMS with better eating. And so I'm getting a sense that you're probably eating pretty well, but then there's also some of the stuff that you said, like the junk is still junk and you're probably eating gluten-free. I'm thinking that there may be way more crap food in the mix than what we're thinking. Was she the one that said 85%, or was that
no,
somebody?
That was
somebody else. Okay, so that's just kind of part one of this, is that you may not actually be eating as well as what you think you're eating, and that there may be more benefit on the PMS side, you know, with some tighter nutrition. Maybe the carbs need to be a little bit lower in general. We don't know what your sleep is, so that's another piece. Like, anything that we can think of regarding insulin resistance and inflammation, sleep, stress, cortisol, vitamin D, like all of the stuff. And so if you're not getting 8 or 9 hours of sleep a night, if it's more like 6 hours and you own a gym and you're up at you know, 4:30 a.m. to run your 5:15 class, those are all biggies. And so there's more of this picture, you know, it's always like sleep, food, you know, training, socialization, like the kind of big picture deal. So that's the stuff that I would be looking at for sure. And then, you know, fish oil for most women seems to help with the PMS type stuff. Although for a few women and people in general, fish oil can be problematic both with regards to PMS and or acne. Some people are kind of paradoxical responders, and they actually need some of the activated omega-6s, like the DGLA that we would get from borage or primrose oil. You don't really know if that's the case until you either experiment with it or you find a good functional medicine doc that can look at what you specifically have going on and can get some sense that maybe you aren't, you've got some inflammatory stuff coming out of actually the omega-3 pathway versus the omega-6 pathways. The other thought with that is just, do you have some sort of a problem clearing normal levels of estrogen? Like, are you kind of estrogen dominant, which can be some liver detox issues? But that also, again, going back, that ties into insulin resistance. If we have elevated insulin levels and we have elevated levels of aromatase, you're converting testosterone into estrogen. So this is why this shit gets really complex when we're talking about women. So, there are things that you can play with, making sure your diet is tighter, tinkering higher on the fish oil, tinkering lower on the fish oil, and having a DGLA instead of fish oil in small doses. But I think that having someone help you with this, doing some blood work, finding somebody on the Paleo Physicians Network, finding a good functional medicine doc, and doing a little bit of blood work, see what's going on under the hood. I would try doing an ASI test just to get a baseline on cortisol. That's going to be the stuff that is going to give you some guidance about where to go. With guys, if they're having problems, it's typically like, I don't feel good. I don't wake up with morning wood. We don't even need blood work. We get their vitamin D levels up. We give them some phosphatidylserine, and they're like, wow, okay, I'm waking, you know, my libido is better. I'm recovering better. Boom, done. With women, it's just a more complex gig. So you've got a number of things to consider there. And again, like, I think a good healthcare provider that can get in, run some blood work, really do a thorough analysis of your nutrition and lifestyle, then you can kind of come back and do this. But if you were going to tackle this on your own, I would tackle the food, make sure it's really good, make sure your sleep is good, get your vitamin D levels checked, make sure it's in the high normal range, and then you start branching out from there.
Well, I have nothing to add in terms of actually addressing the symptoms, but I will say this. I would suggest that you kind of restructure your training and kind of take advantage of this cycle mm-hmm. that you're going to have to deal with in some way, no matter how well you get those symptoms under control. And so that week where you're going to feel like shit, you're not going to want to train, everything's going to feel tough, that needs to be your back off week. And, the week after that, you know, a couple days after you actually start your period, as far as I understand it, that's when your testosterone levels are going to be highest. You're going to feel the best at that point. So why not use that to your advantage? back off that whole week before when you're going to feel shitty anyway. You're not going to be able to train well. Get yourself recovered and then come back that next week and just smoke everything.
Mm-hmm. It's smart. It's smart.
So, I mean, you end up then with basically a 3-week period of loading and 1 week of back off, which is incredibly common in the strength training world as it is. So it's not like you're forced into some odd schedule that doesn't work. I think it would work quite well. And take that week, reduce your volume way down, maybe even back off the more kind of speed and explosive type training where you're going to feel the worst most likely. Really make a focus on your kind of recuperative stuff. Go get your mani-pedi, like go take care of yourself that week so you're not making yourself feel even worse by reminding yourself that you're not able to train as well as you want. And that way, instead of feeling like you're getting screwed by taking a step back that you don't want to, you can feel like, hey, this is exactly what my plan is to back off this week so I can come back stronger next week. That's what I would do.
Super smart. Yeah, I like it.
Because again, you're never, until you go through menopause, you're never just going to get past this. Like, it's always going to be somewhat of an issue. And I have a lot of female weightlifters. I have more female weightlifters than male. And so this is something that we deal with on a regular basis, obviously. And for some of them, it's a really, it makes a big difference. And we have to actually kind of change the program and work around it a bit. For others, there's really no noticeable change. So I can tell you exactly when some of my weightlifters have their periods. A couple others, I don't know because it doesn't affect them. So I would just use it to your advantage as much as possible.
Cool.
All right. This next one, the subject line is proper low bar squat bar position. And the answer is high bar squat position. Anything to add? Just kidding. All right, Tom, we'll take this. Tom says, hello. I've been attempting to squat using the correct low bar position as outlined in Starting Strength by Mark Ripito. However, I'm having some trouble. Ripito states that the bar should rest just below the spine of the scapula, the thumb should be on top of the bar, and the wrist should be straight so that the bar rests on the back and does not put pressure on the wrist joint. My problem is, if I take this position, the bar has to sit somewhere like one-third of the way up my forearm, unless I somehow rip my arms out of my shoulder sockets to move them far enough back for my hands to rest on top of the bar. Is this an acceptable position? I feel like I'm lacking control over the bar this way. I look forward to hearing your suggestions. Rob, why don't you start this so I have some time to calm down and have a more measured response?
You know, coming from a powerlifting background, like I've always gravitated a bit more towards a low bar position. But it's interesting. I've also tended to be about shoulder width, toes more forward than not, full range of movement on this stuff. What this position does, I'm still getting a really full range of movement, well below parallel, but it just shifts the loading onto my glutes and hamstrings a little more, and it doesn't irritate my knees. I love Olympic lifting, like love it, love it, love it. And I've never been able to stick with it long enough to get through the pain that I get in my knees from that more upright torso kind of quad centric squatting. And so the thing that I've come down to is like I drop the bar down a couple inches on my shoulders and I'm good to go. But interestingly, because I've always maintained thoracic mobility and shoulder mobility, I actually get as narrow a grip as I possibly can. I stack my rhomboids and squeeze the shoulder blades together. And it sounds a lot more the way that like Pavel Tsatsulinin and some of the other folks coach the squat position. And it's similar to me when you're getting set up on the deadlift of basically trying to tighten everything up. So when I tinkered with this really wide deal and like my hands draped over the bar, I too did not feel like I had good control over the bar. I didn't feel as tight and integrated, and I didn't feel like I could recruit as hard. And I guess that's kind of the long and short of that. I with all of this stuff, the reason why I like full range of movement squats is because they're really beneficial for the joints. The reason why I like a narrow grip on the bar in squatting is to some degree it's indicative of what your shoulder mobility is. And so if you need to like have your arms out collar to collar and you're kind of like barely draping your shoulders over or your hands over the bar,
there's some thoracic and shoulder mobility issues there that I would really like addressed. And I think addressing that is going to produce a more integrated kind of locked up position on the bar. So hopefully I've rambled long enough that Greg can formulate some coaching stuff on this.
Well, I mean, the reality is that your proportions are going to dictate the position you mm-hmm. can get into. And so it sounds like, Tom, you have probably kind of a shorter upper arm and a longer lower arm. And that's just going to be something you have to deal with. And so really the only way to deal with it, other than ripping your arms out of your shoulder sockets, as you suggested, would be to widen your grip. Because that'll pretty much keep your elbows in about the same position, but then take up some of that extra lower arm length. So you can try that. Honestly, I mean, I don't particularly like that position. I don't particularly like the low bar back squat, but that's a whole nother discussion. So if you feel like that is the way you want to squat, you need to find a way to rack that bar in a manner that is comfortable and secure. Otherwise, you're just setting yourself up for failure from the start. So I would try that wider grip initially. Like Rob said, you really do need to be kind of retracting and even elevating those shoulder blades a little bit. Give yourself a nice kind of soft cushion for that bar to sit on. And, you know, even doing that may help the position a little bit. It might take up some of that extra arm length. But, you know, honestly, if you can't get into a comfortable position like that, you're really in trouble. So you're pretty much going to have to experiment, find exactly the placement you want. If it's not exactly just below the spine of the scapula, then you're probably going to be okay. And if you have to bend your wrists a little bit, you're also going to be okay. Because the reality is, if you're doing a low bar back squat, you're going to be inclined farther forward than you would be otherwise. And again, the bar should be resting on the back and not putting pressure on the wrist joint. So in my opinion, if that's the case anyway, it doesn't really matter if your wrist is extended in a neutral position or, you know, whatever, because there's no pressure on it in the first place. So, you know, work with what you've got and do what you can to make it comfortable and secure. And, like Rob said, you know, he kind of arrived at this sort of hybrid sort of squat because he found with experimentation that that's what worked best for him. And so I would suggest you do the same and just kind of play with this stuff and feel or find out where you feel the most comfortable, where you feel you're going to get the most benefit, and make that your kind of default squat position.
Yeah. And with that said, I will fully endorse that if you've got the orthopedic range, if it works for you, the Olympic style back squat, I think is hands down the best squat to use for like general athletic preparation. For me,
I like that athletical.
Athletical. it's crazy. It's only about two inches difference between like upper trap, lower trap, but it's the whole world of difference for me with regards to knee pain or no knee pain.
I can say from having observed you squat that even though you place the bar a little lower than like I might or some of my lifters might, you still do squat in a pretty upright posture. You don't lean way over.
I don't, but here's the deal. When I was tinkering with Olympic lifting, is that just that little deviation in that position, when I cleaned heavy, I folded over because that was my, and again, you know, like for most people, I still have a very upright squat, but I do not have a fully extended thoracic, posture. And so I found that when I got heavy, that I was consistently defaulting to that stronger position, which was slightly thoracic rounded, which is death on the clean. And that's where that I think the inflection point between being general and then being specific is it's that question again, why are you doing these things? And for me, as much as I love the lifts, like the power clean and power snatch is mainly what I play around with because I can squat in a comfortable manner. But then the loading that I'm subjecting myself to, I'm not getting stapled in the hole because I'm not specifically training the type of positions that I need to be strong enough to handle the loads in those spots.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Ron says, I sometimes get cracks in the corner of my mouth. What should I do? Is it a vitamin deficiency or yeast overgrowth cause and cure? And this whole question, by the way, all the first letters of each word are capitalized like a title.
It's a little bit Seven or serial killer-esque. It's a little creepy.
Don't you capitalize the first letter of all nouns in German?
Think about that. No, I don't think so.
Maybe I just imagined that whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
It seems like something I wouldn't imagine, though. It seems very specific.
Yeah.
But I could be totally wrong.
Yeah.
All right. And then there's a couple links to a Wikipedia thing, like, and an e-zine article.
Angular cheilitis and all that. You know, short answer on this, I have no idea. Longer answer, I've just been doing some reading on the Okinawans, actually a lot of reading, and as healthy as they are and as long-lived as they are, one of the common things that researchers found in these folks was a B vitamin deficiency, which I believe is this angular cheilitis, and it just happened that as nutritious as their diet generally is, there are some B vitamins that they're kind of deficient in. So whether this is like thrush or a B vitamin deficiency, I don't know. I mean, if you're generally eating paleo, it would be surprising to me that you would have a B vitamin deficiency unless you've got some gut permeability stuff. I guess either way, throwing in like a low dose multivitamin would be an easy way to kind of dot your I's and cross your T's on that. But short answer, probably most important answer is I really don't know. but those are some possibilities to dig around.
I also don't know, Ron. Sorry. Okay. This next one is, I don't even know how I'm going to read this subject line. You want to give it a go?
Goal!
I
think
there you go.
It's like soccer when they score.
Yeah.
Football.
Jeff says, Rob and Greg, in numerous past episodes, both of you offered the sage advice that we should evaluate our individual nutrition and training strategies in light of our respective goals. Would you please spend a few moments to discuss your respective views on the process of goal setting? What advice do you give your clients on how they should choose their goals? Do you work with them in that process? If so, how? What are some of the most effective goal setting strategies you have used? How do you go about setting your own personal goals? Many thanks to you both for all you do. Jeff. P.S. Rob, are you banking podcasts, iCaveman style, in anticipation of the Wolf Cubs' arrival?
Yes. I like Indeed. To think it more sperm bank style, but yes. Yes. We're just shooting this stuff out there. But it's interesting in you know, like at NorCal, because we are kind of a CrossFit derivative gym. Like we still have like the elements in level one are sniff very much like a classic CrossFit kind of program. But now we've got a powerlifting / bodybuilding program. We've got no lifting program. We've got a gymnastics program. We have a bunch of other kind of spin-off type classes that we're doing. And so it's, you know, typically the goals that most people have are like they want to look good, they want to be healthy, and they want to have some fun. And so because we've kind of diversified our offerings, it's typically been pretty easy to help people zero in on stuff. And you know, we do strength challenges where people will come in and test their max back squat and power cleans and different stuff like that. I haven't usually found it very difficult. You know, you just kind of talk to people. I guess like on day one, if the person rolls in the gym on day one and you're talking to that person, it's like, so what do you want to do? And the person's a 40-year-old guy who's a former, you know, like collegiate football player, and he's kind of gone to pot and he wants to get lean and get his bench press up again. Or it's a mom, you know, mother of three and she wants to lean out and she doesn't even yet know that she wants to get a pull up. Oftentimes the people don't even know what they want when they first roll in. Like CrossFit's becoming, obviously much more kind of disseminated into the popular culture, and people kind of see that stuff, so they maybe have a little bit more of an intellectual box to put these ideas in. But a lot of times when people first roll in the door, they just want to get lean. They might have some health problems, but typically they just want to look better and everything. And then through the course of time, they get excited about performance, and we just kind of go from there. And, you know, honestly, I have not been one of those really good coaches that, like, sits down quarterly and is like, so what are your goals? What are we going to do? And I've been a little bit more on the experiential side and just kind of there in the process. So I may be bad in that regard. Like, if I was more goal-oriented both for myself and my clients, things might work better. For goal setting in my own life, I've been kind of spastic, but I mean, right now it's just getting as far as I can with jujitsu, and then
just getting jacked and tan.
Yeah, jacked and tan is pretty much it. You know, I'm 40 and I'm going to have a kid, and I'm doing some jujitsu for the bulk of my conditioning. I want to learn how to do some stand up paddleboarding and a little bit of surfing. I really like spearfishing, so I want to be in shape for doing that stuff, and then I want to try to get a one-arm chin again, and I want to get some hand balancing stuff back again, and then I just maintain basic strength numbers on, like, squatting, deadlifting, and all that, which allows me to do other stuff. So my main goals are just being functional to be able to go do stuff, and then hopefully look good enough naked that my wife actually wants to sleep with me. So
that's always a bonus.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jeff, I think honestly you're going to be super disappointed with our answer to this question, because I got to say, I'm kind of like Rob, where I don't do a really good job with the goal setting process. Like, I guess I don't get that involved with it. And I would say I kind of take a similar approach to what Rob described with our fitness clients. And it's definitely with fitness clients, initially it's tends to be very vague. You know, the goal is I want to get fit. And that's fine as a starting point. But then what happens is, as they go on and on, they get more interested in more specific things, and they set goals specific to that. So we actually have a little whiteboard in a part of our gym, like right by the water cooler, that's the goal board, and people will write the next thing they want to work on. So for some people, it's getting, you know, a certain number of consecutive pull-ups or snatching a certain amount of weight. You know, whatever the case is, and they can kind of work towards that. And we even have a little date thing on there, where they can put their target date, so it doesn't just linger on there for 5 years. With that being said, you know, I do fully acknowledge the importance of setting goals. It just doesn't mean I'm good at that. But I think the key, first of all, is that you have kind of multiple levels of goals. In other words, you have your long-term goals, which are pretty ambitious, and then based on that and based on where you currently stand and, you know, the circumstances with which you're working, you set kind of smaller periodic goals that are much more reasonably attained and much sooner attained. So if you have a goal, the ultimate goal is 5 years out, that's really hard to work for. It's very easy to get distracted and go off the rails and get frustrated because you don't feel like you're making measurable progress. Whereas if you set goals that you can reach in a time period that you can measure more like in weeks or even a couple months, that's a lot easier to stay motivated. And the only thing worse than not setting goals is setting goals and not achieving them. That really takes the starch out of your britches. It's very frustrating. It's very discouraging, and it's hard to come back from. So in addition to having kind of that multiple level of goal sort of thing, I would say also that make sure your goals are reasonable. You know, if you are the 40-year-old guy who comes into the gym, don't say, hey, in 2 months, I'm going to snatch 180 kilos, because you're never going to achieve that. And then you're going to feel like an asshole for not doing it. Whereas if you say, okay, for this first 2 months, my goal is to improve my mobility to the point that I can comfortably do an overhead squat with an empty bar, that's easy, very easy to evaluate. You'll be able to tell on a kind of day-to-day, week-to-week basis where you stand in that continuum. And based on that, kind of tweak your training and whatever, and maybe even adjust the goal, the time period a little bit. And then once you hit that goal, you go to your next one, like, okay, I want to be able to snatch 40 kilos. And so taking it in that very stepwise fashion, I think, is really smart. Another thing I would say is that it's helpful, and this has been repeated by a lot of people, but it's helpful to make your goals public. And so that's part of the goal board there, is that other people can hold you accountable for it so you don't slack off. And I think that's very motivating for people, not only because they don't want to embarrass themselves, but because they get the support from other people who are encouraging and who are checking in on them, like, hey, how's it going? You know, where do you stand right now? You know, what do you think you're going to do to make this work? Or, you know, whatever the case is. Or, hey, I did something similar and this is what worked for me. So I think that's a big part of it. And in terms of setting my own personal goals, I'm not really good at this. I have like multiple documents on my computer that have these ridiculously epic lists of things that I'm trying to get done. And that ranges from like the pretty mundane, you know, website maintenance stuff and administrative sort of stuff to pretty ambitious projects. And so it runs the full gamut there. And I think really what I've gotten better at doing is kind of trying to set timelines for these things and prioritizing them. Because one of the biggest problems people have when you're in a position like me and you know, like Rob and things like this, where you have so many different things going on, you got your fingers in so many pies and you got 18,000 pans on the fire, it's very hard to stay on track with one specific project because you're getting pulled in so many directions. And so when you learn to prioritize those things better, I think it's easier to stay on track. And instead of trying to work on 20 things at once and then get nothing done, you say, hey, this has to be done by Friday. So that's got to be number one. It has to get done. This next thing is most important to me, so I'm going to try to get this done by this date. This other stuff can kind of get done whenever I have some spare time. And so in doing that, I think it's a lot easier to be more productive and to better use your time and actually achieve more than you would if you just went, shit, here's a list of 80 things that I want to get done, and we'll just kind of see how I feel each day, and I'll choose as I go.
Nice.
Rob, any final thoughts?
No, I like it. I like it.
Cool. All right.
You know what? I lied. I am going to throw. I will throw one other thought in there.
You're drunk and a liar.
Totally. There's a guy in Chico that runs a very successful, mainly personal training kind of gig. He does some group classes, but it's quite different than what we do at NorCal. Like, it's more bodybuilding oriented. People will come in and lift some weights, and then they'll do, you know, an hour and a half of cardio and stuff like that. And he's really good at getting people motivated with goals, typically more aesthetics based goals. And he has some amazing before and after examples. But the thing that I see within that scene is that he has a shockingly high recidivist rate. Like, people get in, they get fired up, they kind of like sign on for like a 3-month, you know, transformation kind of gig. They go high carb, low fat, calorie restrict, count calories, lots of cardio, lift some weights. They come out the backside looking amazing. And then it's like hookers and cocaine for you know, 4 months. So his scene is kind of built on this kind of revolving door of a very, I don't want to say severe, very significant change in body composition and a very focused, punctuated goal, and then people are gone. And then they roll back in and they feel bad because they don't look anywhere near as good as their previous best and stuff like that. And I think to some degree that's why I've been a little bit easier or more lax on the super focused goal, instead of it just being a little bit more experiential, but, you know, then doing the stuff like Greg just alluded to, but just trying to make it something that you're going to do for your life. You know, find stuff that you want to do for your life, and not that every single thing that you do, like if you want to go try some Thai boxing or do some jits or, you know, do whatever, it's not that you have to marry that thing and do it forever, but, you know, finding stuff that you kind of like and then say, oh, this seems cool. I really like this and I want to kind of go deep on it. And in that regard, and then you start dropping in the like incremental short goals. I'm going to, you know, like for me, my goal is to hit at least 3 Brazilian jiu-jitsu classes a week by hook or by crook. If I only get 2, then I really, really, really try to watch some Brazilian jiu-jitsu video while I'm eating and stuff like that, just while I'm thinking about it. So I've made some goals to make some progress in that area, and then I set them up, and I just kind of go. And a lot of that is just kind of showing up and doing the things that you need to do versus, like, the end goal of, like, I'm going to be a black belt someday. It's just kind of like, how do you get to that end stage? Well, you show up. How often do you show up? As much as is reasonable given your schedule and stuff. So that was just something that popped into my head.
Cool.
Probably could be edited out, and we would have not any loss in substantive content, but oh well.
That could be said about 90% of what I say, at least. So let's not worry about it.
Sweet.
This next one is gum recession a paleo side effect? Jen says, Rob and the, quote, the ever large and in charge, Greg Everett.
Mm.
You guys are amazing.
Nice.
Thanks, Jen.
Yeah.
I've listened to all the podcasts twice, and I've heard you guys talk a decent amount about gum recession. I've also seen several tweets on the topic. I've always had some issues with gum recession, but I've noticed that it's a lot worse since I started eating 100% paleo in July of 2011. I take 200 milligrams of CoQ10 each day, as Rob suggests. I use a Sonicare toothbrush very gently. I floss every day, and I swish with the purple Listerine that my dentist recommended. A few years ago, I had to have some gum from the roof of my mouth grafted on my lower gums because the root of one of my teeth was nearing exposure. I definitely do not want to have these surgeries throughout my life. I'm only 27, otherwise super healthy and pretty dang hot with 2 T's. I'm not sure why my gums have gotten so much worse since starting paleo. Maybe reducing all the inflammation has caused my gums to decrease in size / puffiness. That doesn't really make sense, does it? Help, I want a purdy mouth. P.S. I did Google this first, so don't verbally spank me. Didn't find anything from sources that I trust and would love to hear some opinions from you too.
I do like that people are at least living in fear of that at this point.
Just getting humiliated.
At least we've created a culture of fear, yeah.
Oh, boy.
You know, a couple of things pop out here. One thing, Eva T usually listens to the podcast, so maybe...
Hi, Eva.
Hey, Eva. Congratulations on being inducted into the Skiing Hall of Fame, which is absolutely amazing, in addition to... you know, being a former 2-time Olympian and 6-time world champion,
There's no such thing as a former Olympian.
Is it kind of like a Marine? Eva, you're always Olympian?
That into my head.
Okay.
Once you went to the Olympics, you're an Olympian.
Okay. I stand corrected.
And get it right.
Since she is Polish, she will occupy me and crush me. So, but the couple of things that pop out here, one is the Listerine, actually, because it is actually a drying agent. And Eva had counseled me to ditch the Listerine type stuff and actually do Biodyne if I did any type of a rinse. So that's the first thing that pops up there. The second thing that pops up, I guess, is just have you actually had the pockets checked, and are they legitimately receding, or is this like a visual deal? I mean, what type of quantifiers do we have going on here? Because I mean, the number of people that I've and again, this is all anecdotal, but it's anecdotal either side of the fence. So, you know, I don't know what to say, but tons and tons of people saying, hey, my gum recession reversed with paleo. That's not to say that we're not going to have a paradoxical responder. But it, again, you know, typically if you drop inflammation, this stuff tends to improve. So I would be curious about, have you had this stuff legitimately measured? And if so, what has been the vector? Like, are legitimately, like, the pockets getting greater? Do we have, you know, do we have legit gum recession? Then the other side of that is that I know when I was using Listerine that I did have some problems, and then as soon as I ditched the Listerine, things were much better.
Cool.
That's all I've got on that.
Yeah, I don't really have anything other than good luck with that. And you're welcome for no verbal spanking.
Yes.
Let's see. Jeff in Brooklyn says, Dear Rob and Greg, first off, thank you so much for what you guys are doing. Between the podcast, website, and Rob's book, coupled with the awesome paleo community, I've been able to correct my dietary ways and lose 50 pounds. I've lost 10 inches off my waist. I rarely get sick. I sleep great when my one-month-old lets me. And I have great energy and I'm able to concentrate better than ever. There is one last health issue that won't go away, my high blood pressure. My BP tends to run between 140 over 80 to 155 over 100, far from the previous highs of 180 over 110, holy smokes, but far from my goal of 120 over 80 or less. I've tried everything from increasing my magnesium supplementation, eating more potassium-rich foods, cutting salt, increasing salt, quitting caffeine, etc., with no avail. I've done some heavy Googling, and all I usually find are success stories using the standard paleo diet protocol. What are your thoughts on this? Am I missing something? Should I up my activity level? I unfortunately cannot afford a gym membership, so it would consist of bodyweight exercises and sprints slash light jogging. I am due for my annual physical, so should I ask for some specific blood work? Am I using too many commas and parentheses in this letter? No, that's what punctuation is for.
It so actually makes it possible to read.
Yeah. I'm at a loss here, and I'm scared of what's going to happen long-term cardiovascularly or when I up my life insurance next. By the way, do you know of a way to drop my blood pressure just for the medical exam in case I can't get it down by then? Seriously. Any help would be greatly appreciated. Thanks again for all your help, and thanks in advance for hopefully answering my question.
You know, I just when you look at the list of supplements here, it looks pretty solid. Looks like he's taken 10,000 IUs of vitamin D3. One question that I would ask, though, is have you had your vitamin D levels checked? There was just like literally 2 hours ago, I was sifting through the literature that I get in my inbox, and there was a pretty well done study comparing vitamin D supplementation with Lasix and some of these water shedding drugs for dropping blood pressure, and the vitamin D ended up performing really, really well relative to ACE inhibitors and stuff like that. So I would make sure that your vitamin D levels are good. You could try a ketogenic paleo version because, I mean, if you really, low carb, low protein, higher fat, go into ketosis, that's going to drop insulin levels like crazy. You're going to diurese like crazy. Your performance probably isn't going to be spectacular on that other than in kind of low-level aerobic type stuff. But, if you don't have an aneurysm because of the high blood pressure, that might be a good thing. So, I mean, a ketogenic diet definitely can peel water out of a person and therefore drop insulin levels and aldosterone and the retained sodium and all that sort of jive. And then I've noticed that in a lot of people, if their blood pressure, you can have blood pressure elevations. Backing up again, the things that influence blood pressure are fluid volume and the vascular bed tonicity. And so, if you're addressing all the vascular, the fluid volume from like the dietary side, vitamin D and all that stuff, then the other side to consider is like the just neurological tonicity. And if one were to get their hands on like 5 milligrams of Valium and they took that and they took their blood pressure and the blood pressure was much lower, then you would know that there's kind of a neuro element to this, like literally just kind of like a stress element. And then I think we've mentioned in some of the past podcasts that like some biofeedback can be really, really powerful in that regard. So
yeah,
there you have it.
Yeah, do you want to give him any tricks for trying to lower the blood pressure for a test?
Well, I just did.
Well, the biofeedback? More specific?
The Valium?
Right.
I'm trying not to practice too much medicine without license, but
now, what about just getting him to control his breathing a little bit and simple things like that?
Yeah, I mean, and that like there are some really good biofeedback things you can get for your iPhone or your Android. And so those are some simple things that you can do that will literally give you almost immediate feedback as to whether or not you can budge that stuff down.
Yeah, you should be able to get a decent drop in blood pressure if you can slow your breathing way down.
Yeah, yeah. You start ramping up that parasympathetic side of things, and you should get some vascular relaxation in the.
Just relax, man.
Dude, chill.
All right. Sergeant Ayala says, hello. First off, I would like to say thank you for reading this email and also for providing the world with such a wonderful education on nutrition. I've been eating paleo since 2011 and without a doubt, it has changed my life. I even have my soldiers on it. I guess my question is, with all the fitness systems out there and all the controversy that surrounds each one of them, which would be ideal for the warfighter? My platoon sergeant and I are looking for a fitness system that would replace the Army fitness program that does a really good job at creating injuries. My soldiers and I have used conventional training methods and never really achieved good results. People say Jim Jones is the answer. Then another says CrossFit. Still others say Stu Smith programs are best. I'm pretty stubborn to change, so if I do change, I want to know I'm not wasting my time. Thank you again for your time and patience.
Gosh, you know, when I look at, when you break down most military performance, like we've been doing a lot more work with the special operations community, which is a little bit different than, say, like standard infantry and stuff like that. But it's interesting. A ton of the preparatory stuff. Let me back up again. There's a difference. Within the military and police and fire, there's a need for selection processes. So, like, when somebody goes through BUDS or they go through different, like Ranger School or whatever, there's a bunch of stuff that they go through, long runs, long swims, no sleep, all that sort of stuff, that is part of a selection process to see what type of mental toughness the person has, what happens when the person finally does come unstitched. And you know, there's all these kind of rubrics with that, and it's horrible stuff, but it's also critical so that, you know, you have the right type of people in the right types of things. But what I find oftentimes is that people in the military and the leadership has kind of mistaken selection processes for being beneficial for general preparation, which I don't really agree with. When we look at the needs of most military personnel, you aren't running for miles at a time. You aren't even humping a rucksack for miles and miles at a time. Now, some people who are special operators, they are. This is a different story, and this is where you need to be, like, you know, hauling your rucksack around and getting work hardened to that stuff. But when you look at the bulk of the demands that people have, they need to be strong enough to haul a lot of gear. They need more anaerobic type activity than they do, or specifically aerobic activity, although the aerobic activity that they need probably needs to be more specific to be being laden with body armor, rucksacks, and all the rest of that, and able to move over uneven terrain for long distances potentially, and or move from points of cover very quickly and mobily. And I don't see the bulk of the training that folks are doing looking anything remotely like that. It doesn't look at all like what the daily preparation is. You get a bunch of long runs. You get a ton of push-ups, sit-ups, maybe some pull-ups, some flutter kicks. And then somehow all of that long, grinding, low-level activity is supposed to then translate into carrying a rucksack that may be like 75 or 100 pounds. And, like, there's no preparation that is protecting the low back. We have, like, tons of low back injuries. We have tons of knee and ankle problems because we're not really loading people in a super, you know, above the levels of their work with squatting and deadlifting and some smart use of ballistic movements like kettlebell and dumbbell swings, maybe like a power clean or something if it's properly coached. And so my gut sense is something that looks a hell of a lot more like what John Wellborn does with the power athlete CrossFit football kind of gig, which is some heavy lifting, some short change of direction type sprints so that we build athleticism, and then probably one long effort, maybe two long, you know, one long effort a week, probably with a rucksack, and then maybe interval type stuff with your kit that is situational. So you're moving from points of cover to points of cover, stand up, sit down, crawl, I mean, that sort of stuff. And in, you know, 5, 10, 15, maybe as far as 30-yard increments, but more on like the scramble, you know, 5 to 10-yard cuts going from point to cover, and you've got all your gear on and stuff like that, and needing to cover a chunk of ground under a certain period of time. And to me, when you look at the work demands of war fighting, that looks a hell of a lot more like what we need. So you've got some, not surprisingly, we have some general physical preparedness that we do in the gym, and then we have some sport-specific stuff that we're doing, it's sport being in quotations. I when I do my talks, I always call these folks warrior athletes because I see the work demands being inseparable from what we would see with high-level professional athletes. So, but, you know, again, if we look at an MMA fighter or a wrestler or even like a 10,000-meter swimmer, the demands of their job are very, very different, and the GPP that they need and the SPP that they need are very, very different. So I think it's being clear about what the needs of the person are, and then, you know, understanding the an adequate general base that develops people and makes them ready to go out and do the tasks that they need to do, that coupled with an understanding of how do we do sport-specific training or task-specific training, and just being really specific about that. And you know, like, I think the Jim Jones stuff is good. Stu Smith has some good stuff, but I really like what Wellborn does, or that template of sprinting, lifting, and then that's your GPP, but then also having rolled into that your SPP stuff where you're wearing your kit, you're covering ground, you're doing situational type stuff. That seems like a really good combo to me.
I like it. I agree wholeheartedly.
Sweet.
All right. Well, let's wrap this up with one more question.
Awesome.
And it is antidepressants and anti-anxiety medications, the anti-paleo solution for depression and anxiety. Will says, Rob and Greg, I'm a big fan of the podcast and all the work both you guys do. I'm relatively new to the whole paleo scene, basically been following it strict for a little over a month now. I have a few generic questions regarding the use of antidepressants, SSRIs, and or anti-anxiety medications and possible implications on blunting the benefits of a strict paleo diet. I'm 26 and I was recently put on low-dose SSRI, Zoloft, as well as Wellbutrin for anxiety, though my question pertains to all antidepressant and anti-anxiety medications. I've been reading a lot of mixed reviews on the internet dealing with the downsides of SSRIs, specifically their negative effects on cortisol and more generally their overall impact on the adrenal system. I've read multiple articles claiming that single doses, just taking one pill one time and never taking it again, of an SSRI can double your cortisol levels. Another article argued that SSRIs could mask the indicators of adrenal fatigue, which could in fact be the source of one's anxiety and or depression. Finally, I have read that these medications can be bad for the gut and prevent it from fully healing. A lot of these points I have read in Chris Kresser's work, and I know he is adamantly against taking antidepressants. So my questions: do antidepressants and anti-anxiety medications impact cortisol levels, adrenal glands, irritate the gut, and or cause any other paleo-blunting, parentheses, general health results? If healing the gut and regulating components of one's endocrine system is vital to good health, can a person on SSRIs and other anti-anxiety medications still achieve the full benefits of a paleo diet, or can optimal results only be achieved once the medications are stopped? Finally, if the antidepressants and anti-anxiety medications do have a negative impact on achieving optimal results from paleo, is it a trade-off worth making? For example, if I have rough anxiety and or depression that causes fatigue as well as puts me in a constant state of stress, is it worth taking medications to mitigate those stressors? Basically, I could function without the medications, though likely in a much more heightened state of stress due to my anxiety, which would likely create cortisol/insulin issues anyway. If SSRIs are as bad as I have read, I am stuck in a bit of a catch-22 here. Either I'll get elevated cortisol from anti-anxiety meds, or I'll get it from not taking the meds. Should I stick with the meds, or should I try to kick the medication, safely, and focus only on using paleo and supplements to help with my anxiety? If so, what supplements should I use? Thanks for all the help. Keep up the good work.
Holy cat.
Man, it's really hard to say anti-anxiety meds over and over.
Like 50 times. Do antidepressants, anti-anxiety medications impact cortisol levels, mask adrenal glands? Yeah, I think they totally do. I forget when it was. I was having some conversation with, it was a long, long time ago, a doc that was at the University of Washington Medical Center, and they have kind of an integrated health scene there, and they were talking about the use of antidepressants and that, you know, it's comparatively benign. It'll get people back into doing their day-to-day, life functions. And I kind of made the point, I'm like, but aren't you just kind of masking the stuff that they have going on and just kind of facilitating them continuing to do the things that are causing problems? And she was kind of thinking about it. And she's like, actually, that's kind of true in a way. But then, you know, you never really know the individual's life situation. Like, is somebody caretaking a dying parent and, without some sort of support, like, this is going to be the last freaking straw. And so this is, you know, the short answer with this is I think your concerns with these things are fairly valid. But as to whether or not it's a viable cost-benefit analysis. Nobody can know that other than you and your doc. I mean, you need to, as clearly as you can, look at what your situation is and what you're contending with, and you know what are the things in your life that you're dealing with. Can they be modified to a degree that it's not like you said, causing other effects in the rest of your life? There are some people that have such severe depression or anxiety because of like childhood trauma or PTSD or whatever, that without an intervention, like they stay literally in this neurological loop and they can never break out and they can never make progress via counseling and stuff like that. And that's really bad news. But then when you look into the literature on antidepressants, there's a not insignificant rate of suicide and stuff like that with people who take antidepressants. When you watch like all the TV commercials talking about antidepressants, you have butterflies flying around and everybody's happy. And then it's like side effects include death, suicide, and general mayhem, you know? And so...
Yeah, it's always great to hear that one of the most common side effects of antidepressants is depression.
Yeah.
And suicidal thoughts.
Yeah. And so, I mean, there's definitely... I'm in this, I think, maybe not unique spot, but I'm in a little bit of a different spot, maybe because of the pharmacology, biochemistry background or whatever, but I like to look into our pharmacopoeia and use that stuff when it makes sense and not throw my hands up and say, well, you know, it's not natural, then that's a problem and stuff like that. But, you know, like in this situation, I would be way more interested before going on antidepressants. I would be really interested to know what are your vitamin D levels? What is the photo exposure you're getting on a day-to-day basis? What are your testosterone levels? I would go out on a limb and probably say that I would be surprised if you didn't have low testosterone levels. Now, it may be 400 to 500 or something like that, 300 to 400, somewhere in there. And if you do, that may fall under the normal bell curve, but I can guarantee you, you are not going to feel normal on that protocol. Like you're just not. Is that due to sleep? Is that due to endogenous biotoxins that are competing with testosterone production? I don't know. But I do know that you don't have a Zoloft deficiency. You don't have a Prozac deficiency. You might have a testosterone deficiency or vitamin D deficiency or something like that. And for me, this is an interesting thing. It is shockingly controversial within mainstream medicine to look at trying to optimize hormonal levels as a means of dealing with disease relative to simply throwing a bunch of different drugs which treat symptomology. And treating symptomology with drugs that have highly suspect side effects, you know, like death and depression, you know, in the case of these things, is okay. Docs are okay with that generally. But it's very, very controversial to suggest, well, maybe this person should do some DHEA plus Arimidex or maybe even some testosterone cream to try to get their endogenous testosterone levels up. And that deals with the depression. To me, that seems much more natural, much more biodynamic, and oftentimes addresses things much more, if you've got elevated cortisol levels, then you probably have a pregnenolone steal, and if you have pregnenolone steal, then the testosterone levels are low. So, that you know, there's this whole feedback loop. Would it be good to figure out what is going on with all that stuff? Absolutely, and typically a paleo diet plus good vitamin D plus, you know, stress modulation and everything is going to be important. I can tell you this, when I lived in Seattle, like I lived there for 6 years, and that was 5 years, 11 months, and 29 days too fucking long. I love the city. It's amazing people. It's good food. And the lack of sun there, like it was just a horrible idea on my part. And even Chico, you guys have heard me joke about like the Kurt Cobain deal. Chico has chunks of time where it gets really cloudy and overcast, and like I would just get squirrely as hell. Reno is much, much more sunny, but even the past couple of days, we've had a couple of days where it was like solid morning to night overcast, and I am not a happy camper on those days. The sun's coming out right now, and I'm way better. So there's a lot of environmental stuff that I think you can tinker with that can improve this stuff. So I don't know that I answered any of these questions specifically, but I think there's a way bigger picture here, and I would like to see doctors – looking at this more from a holistic, integrative level, considering hormone levels and stuff like that beyond just cortisol first versus just simply throwing people on antidepressants, but with the caveat that there are absolutely people that their life situation is such that it is wholly appropriate for them to be using SSRIs or anti-anxiety meds. And you just need to be educated and kind of play a little bit of a selective gamble on that stuff.
Yeah. I have no business really adding to any of that, but I definitely would agree with the fact that sometimes it's certainly a necessity, and ideally in those cases, it's a temporary situation. And, you know, there's certainly a lot that can be done to work through the causes of the problems, whether they're physical or psychological, to get to a point where you may need less or no medication. So I think that should always be the end goal.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, I hate to end on such a depressing note. Thanks, Chris.
Seriously. Buzzkillerama. No, jeez. It's complex stuff. It definitely is. But I know for myself that, you know, spending less time inside, like I've really been partitioning my life, and like I work from basically 6 a.m. till about noon doing internet-related stuff, and then I'm done. And I try to be outside, sun on my skin as much as I possibly can, and I get a good 6 hours in, and then usually in the evening I come back in and do another couple hours of work. So I've got like a good 8 to 9 hours a day that I'm doing some dedicated work, but I try to break that up and get some sun, and definitely my life is better. Like I feel better. I'm more upbeat, more focused, all that stuff.
Living the dream out there in Reno.
Indeed. Indeed. Brothels only a short drive away. So it's awesome.
Excellent.
Yes.
Cool.
All right, G. Thanks, man. Two on the books. Maybe we'll have a wolf cub here somewhere in the mix. We will reunite here in a couple of weeks.
Excellent.
Awesome, man. Thanks. We'll talk to you soon.
You bet. See ya.
Bye.